On this week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin, Mr. Oliver Riss, and Mr. Brian Chi on the show today. Full panel. And this week we talk about how finding qualified personnel to meet the continual demand to battle against cybersecurity is definitely a challenge. The question is, what can organizations do? We'll talk about that. Plus, we have a special treat today. We have the full panel of hosts to take you through the looking glass of the future into the cashless world. What does it look like? Where are we headed? Is it all crypto? Lots to talk about there. You definitely shouldn't miss it. Twiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 492, recorded May 6th, 2022. Cashless is king. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Nuvei. Say goodbye to abandoned carts, poor approval rates, and high chargebacks with Nuvei, the platform fast-forwarding to the next generation of payments. Turn payments into powerful accelerators for your business at Nuvei.com. And by Linode. Develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications faster and easier. Get $100 in credit. Visit Linode.com/Twiet. And by Nareva. Traditional audio conferencing systems can entail lots of components. Installation can take days, and you might not get the mic coverage you need. That's complex expensive. But Nareva Audio is easy to install and manage, no technicians required, and you get true full room coverage. That's easy, economical. Learn more at Nareva.com. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals and the experts, starting with our contributing editor at PC Mag. He's Mr. Oliver Riss. Oliver, so great to have you back. What's going on with you? What's going on this week for you?
It's really good to be back. I just got back from vacation in the wine-infused Napa country, so I'm getting over a bunch of headaches. and then next week I'll be back at PC Mag testing CRMs. So that's my life for right now.
Now you recently had a CRM spread come out, right? There was this recent one that I saw.
The first half, and now I'm testing the second half, and then also the child one, which is best small business CRMs. So I got a lot of CRM stuff happening.
Very interesting stuff. We'll have to have you back again as well to talk a lot more about that, because I think that's an interesting area for our audience. Thanks for being here. Well, we also have to welcome back our security analyst. He's senior analyst at Omdia, and he's Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, welcome back to the show. What's been keeping you busy?
Oh, I have, in fact, been staying busy, Lou. I'm deep into research on cybersecurity awareness training, doing a lot of stuff on that, beginning to look at risk quantification, which will be my big thrust for the second part of the year. And the big thing is getting ready for RSA. I am having floods of invitations to meet fall into my inbox. So I'm looking forward to being out in San Francisco for that. And then you know what? Black Hat will be on us before you know it. Actually, Black Hat Asia is happening next week. It's going to be exciting to hear what happens with this fairly large in-person security event that's going on. Hope that all is well and that it presages good things to come.
I can definitely tell you Black Hat of any of the events keep software and security people on their toes. That's for sure. They were always fearful of those weeks coming up. We'll see what comes out of those in the next couple of weeks. Well, we also have to welcome back our neck architect at SkyFiber, an all-around tech geek. He's Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, great to see you, my friend. What's been keeping you busy?
Actually, migrating from my 1995 era MacBook Pro over to the new M1 Mac Mini. And I got to say, it was clean. I didn't have any glitches at all, which is really cool. Wow. But I will say to Burke, sorry, that's not my steampunk keyboard. I actually went to an Apple Magic keyboard. So I'm going to have to make sure I mute when I'm typing. My bad.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad you had a chance to upgrade. It's definitely a worthy upgrade. I have my M1 MacBook. Love it. I use it for a lot of things. So congratulations there. Well, speaking of lots of things to do and lots of enterprise things going on, it's been a very busy week in the enterprise, so we definitely should get started here. Now, the current cybersecurity landscape continues to evolve at a record pace. That means you need the pros to stay ahead of the curve. That's the hard part, right? Making sure you have enough qualified people to help you there. Now, what if you could start right now by rolling out some kind of mentorship program there? Would it help? Well, we'll discuss that and talk a little bit more about that as well. Plus, we have a special treat today. We have a full panel of hosts, and we're going to talk a little bit about their view into the looking glass around the cashless society, the cashless world. Now, what does it look like? Where are we headed? Maybe it includes crypto. Maybe it doesn't. Lots to talk about there, so you should definitely stick around till later. But before we get to all those topics, there has been a lot of things going on in the enterprise world, so let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. We don't have to go too many enterprise weeks without a leak. That's right. This week, it's Heroku, the Salesforce-owned cloud platform as a service that enables developers to build, run, and operate cloud applications entirely in the cloud. Now, you may remember news about them being hit by a cyber attack last month, but the impact of the attack was not fully clear. Now, they have now revealed that the stolen GitHub integration OAuth tokens from the last month's attack further led to the compromise of an internal customer database. That's right. The same compromised token was used by attackers to exfiltrate customers' hashed and salted passwords from an internal database. Now, this week, Heroku started performing forced password resets for a subset of its users' accounts after last month's security incident without fully explaining why. The original security incident referred to threat actors stealing OAuth tokens issued to Heroku and Travis CI and abusing these to download data from private GitHub repositories belonging to dozens of organizations, including NPM. On April 12th, GitHub Security began an investigation and uncovered the evidence that an attacker abused stolen OAuth user tokens issued to third-party OAuth integrators Heroku and Travis CI to download from dozens of organizations, including NPM. It turns out the compromised token for Heroku machine account obtained by threat actors also allowed unauthorized access into Heroku's internal database of customer accounts. So there's been lots of speculation about how Heroku handled this attack breach and why they shouldn't have done it this way. Lots of flyby readers and commenters felt that they're the poster child for how not to handle communication to their customers in scenarios like these. However, the cloud platform feels that after working with GitHub, threat intel vendors, industry partners, and law enforcement during the investigation, it had reached a specific point where more information could be shared without compromising the ongoing investigation. That makes sense. Now, it just goes to show you that a lot of these breaches have such an impact, it takes time to actually figure out how deep they actually go. That makes me wonder, with the recent legislation that's out there that's in the pipe, if the response rate and the depth will need to change in the near future.
Well, speaking of things that are moving attacks to the top of the concern list, SolarWinds and Log4Shell made sure that software supply chain attacks are at the top of the enterprise worry list when those supply chain catastrophes sent shockwaves to the IT security community. Partially in response, NIST has just updated its cybersecurity guidelines and advice for addressing software supply chain risks, offering sets of suggested security controls tailored to the needs of various supply chain participants. This latest publication offers specific risk management guidance for roles including cybersecurity specialists, risk managers, system engineers, and procurement professionals. Each profile matches up with a set of recommended controls, like implementing secure remote access mechanisms for working with the software supply chain, or finally deploying least privilege access, or taking an inventory of all software suppliers and products. Security professionals are increasingly concerned about the safety of the open source components and third-party libraries that are now part of thousands of applications. In addition, threat actors have proven that software repository and update platforms can be abused, as happened in the Kaseya attack last year when cybercriminals comprised a managed application, or with SolarWinds, where they hacked an update mechanism to deliver malware. This latest set of guidelines has been released based on guidance from an executive order issued by President Biden last year, which directs government agencies to improve the security and integrity of the software supply chain with a priority on addressing critical software.
All righty. If you are at all associated with an ISP in the United States, you should be reading about this legislation. This is quite a bit beyond those MPAA takedown notices we've all become aware of, and that the legislation seems to be saying that someone has to also keep aware of name changes on those illegal sites, since it states, quote, all ISPs and any other ISPs providing services in the United States shall block access to the website at any domain address known today or to be used in the future by the defendants by any technological means available on the ISP systems. What isn't pointed out is who is responsible for keeping track of the names and addresses used by the defendants in the future. The article goes on to talk about how credit card companies must no longer process transactions for those sites with language that sure sounds like money laundering verbiage. So what I find interesting is the legislature goes on to include ISPs, web hosts, CDN providers, DNS providers, domain name companies, advertising services, financial institutions, payment processors, etc., from doing any business with the sites at their current domains or new ones. So my counterpoint is to ask our Congress critters about just how these internet service providers are going to keep track of these illegal download sites when even law enforcement has trouble keeping track of all the illegal download sites. My goodness. My comment is that trying to keep track of all these sites will be nearly impossible without the aid of an outside agency, and that the cost of staying compliant could very well drive smaller ISPs out of business.
The Ukraine is not the only country with a fleeing population, so the war and the crippling subsequent sanctions have skilled Russian workers apparently climbing over each other to get out of the country, and that's resulted in an IT shortage even worse than the one that we have. So Russia's businesses and even its government apparently need to find replacements and right quick, so they've decided to tap the ultimate work-from-home employee, convicts. So as Krebsen Security, a market research firm, reports, late last month, the Russian Federal Penitentiary Service announced that it was considering using prisoners for remote IT work at commercial Russian companies. So there's thought to be around 95,000 open IT positions in Russia right now, mainly because those IT specialists are skedaddling so fast that they're leaving skid marks. And Russia estimates up to 100,000 or so such workers have left for countries like ours, Germany, Georgia, Cyprus, Canada. Which is good news for us as far as our IT shortage goes, but it's bad news for Russia. Then again, at least Russia doesn't have a shortage of prisoners. BBC says they currently have a prison population of around 875,000. How many of those have IT skills is unknown, but if even only 1 in 10 have them, then there's a chance that, you know, Russia could fill a whole bunch of those vacant roles. You also get some probably get some happy prisoners, but I doubt that's a priority. Businesses will also be happy because apparently the average Russian forced labor prisoner makes about $281 a month. So some Russian cons may trade their license plate making machines for a PC and a network management app, which is good for them. But it begs the question, who's going to watch for all that malware and backdoor code exploits that these guys are going to do while they have their hands on those keyboards? And worse, I'm not really expecting 100,000 or 95,000 Russian prisoners to have multi-cloud network administration skills. However, I am expecting around 200 or even 300,000 Russian prisoners to claim that they do. So in the end, it might not be crime that makes this a big problem for Russia long term. It might be sheer incompetence.
And with the recent news on the impact chip makers are having on the supply chain, lots of countries and manufacturers are looking for ways to bring things closer to home. In fact, Germany's own government is looking to attract chip makers to the country by offering $14.7 billion in financial support. Now, the move follows the European Chips Act from the European Commission and Intel's decision earlier this year to build a new fabrication plant in Germany. Now, this state aid isn't the first of its kind in this area, but it may be just enough to raise the interest of chip manufacturers. Now, recent chip shortages that are causing problems in a lot of the industries, including the automobile sector and IT equipment makers, which have been reportedly led to some vendors buying washing machines to rip out the chips for reuse. It's actually quite amazing to see how deep the impact is due to the semiconductor industry. Now, the European Commission recently unveiled its European Chips Act, which proposes a number of initiatives to boost semiconductor research and development within the EU and building new production capabilities and capacities to lessen European reliance on chip supplies from countries like China. Now, it starts with an initial investment of $11.6 billion, which is expected to rise to more than $45 billion of public and private investments by 2030. Now, the U.S. is also trying to prime government investment in semiconductor manufacturing and R&D with the U.S. CHIPS Act, which was signed into law in 2021, but needs a further piece of legislation, America Competes Act, to be passed in order to unlock a potential $52 billion of funding to boost chip production stateside. Now, India is also doing something very similar. The most interesting thing here is that despite the shortages and supply chain issues, the global semiconductor market is still expected to hit $676 billion during 2022. That's almost 13% increase from last year. Now, we just have to find ways to actually get them. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Nuvei, tomorrow's payment platform designed to accelerate your business. Now, is your payment provider holding your business back? Well, Nuvei's next generation payment technology not only boosts conversions, reduces fraud, and increases approval rates, but works seamlessly with your existing tech stack. Now, you can connect to Nuvei's platform via a single API integration. I'd love to hear that as a software developer. Now, with Nuvei's agile platform, your business will also be allowed to add new payment methods, enter more markets, and meet evolving customer demands so you can stay ahead of the curve. Now, Nuvei offers more than 550 alternative payment methods, including cryptocurrencies, with local payment solutions around the world. Nuvei also offers local acquiring in 46 countries and more than 200 global markets. Now, customers also benefit from all payout options, card issuing, banking, and fraud management services. Nuvei can handle any high demand peak event. Their always on approach ensures 99.999% uptime, and they offer flexible a la carte solutions that are tailored to your needs. Nuvei is the payment partner for some of the world's leading global brands. That's why, including Wix, Valve, DraftKings, General Motors, Valentino, Crypto.com, and many more. Now, with future proof technology and a dedicated team, 24/7, 365 human support professionals, Nuvei prepares your business for whatever comes next. Say goodbye to abandoned carts, poor approval rates, and high chargebacks with Nuvei, the platform fast forwarding to the next generation of payments. Turn payments into powerful accelerators for your business at Nuvei.com. That's Nuvei.com. Nuvei, tomorrow's payment platform. And we thank Nuvei for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, finding qualified personnel to meet the continual demand to battle against trending landscapes such as cybersecurity is a challenge. The question is, what can organizations do? Take us through it is Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis?
Thanks, Lou. I appreciate it. And we have a couple of things that come together in this story. One is that there is an ongoing and, according to many professionals, unbridgeable gap between the number of cybersecurity professionals that exist and the number of cybersecurity professionals that we need. According to some of the companies involved in certifying cybersecurity pros, there's going to be a long-term global gap of at least 500,000 cybersecurity professionals. So what do we do to at least make that gap as small as possible? Now, one of them is to grow your own. And while formal training is important and we cannot de-emphasize it, it's also critical to have mentors, professionals who have been in the business for a while, who can talk to the growing cybersecurity professional and give them advice, not only on the technology that they need to be aware of and the strategies that they need to be know, but all of the human pieces, how to work with professionals in other parts of the organization. Now, Bishop Fox is a company that is heavily involved in the cybersecurity world. And one of their security practice directors says that you must build your own talent, that buying it just isn't practical. And if you've seen the kind of salaries being offered for any kind of seniority in cybersecurity, you understand that this is true. So what do you do? Now, he gave some advice. You send out an internal survey to find out who might be interested in becoming a cybersecurity professional. You have your mentors and the system help them meet their goals. And this may, to be honest, require helping them understand what those goals are. Let's face it, if you're not in the cybersecurity world, do you know what red teaming, blue teaming, purple teaming means? And if you have the vague idea of what it means, do you have any really strong idea of what's involved in being a member of each of those teams? Now, I know that we've had among our co-hosts a lot of experience, frankly, on both sides of the mentor relationship. One of the people that has done it a lot and frankly is well known in the industry for being a mentor is our own Brian Chi. So let me ask you, Brian, in for a mentorship program to be effective, how formal does it have to be? In other words, how rigidly does the organization need to support it if it's going to be successful in growing professionals?
And this is my opinion. It all really depends on the organization itself. If it's somebody that has a lot of structure and needs that structure, then it needs to be a fairly formal program. The Advanced Network Computing Laboratory at the University of Hawaii was not formal at all. While I was one of the biggest testing labs for InfoWorld magazine and before that Internet Week magazine, my students got a chance to work with industry professionals and exchange ideas, learn from them and so forth. And it was a very casual thing, but I provided an environment for them to learn. Now, the only thing that was formal about my program was the concept of a practicum. Now, my wife is what used to be the university librarian at Hawaii Pacific University. She has a master's in library science. When she was actually attending, a practicum was a requirement. You could not graduate if you did not have practical experience working as a pseudo professional in a real library. Now, the Novell Certified Network Instructor Program used to have a practicum, and I was one of the first 10 in the world. Basically, it was the 10 distributors of Novell Network. We were allowed to have one instructor apiece. The concept of having a practicum was actually required. You actually had to go and do real life stuff before they would certify you. So here's the thread. I think being able to work with industry professionals, even if it's holding the instruments while they're doing the testing or watching over your shoulder, as long as you don't shut them down when they're asking questions, you can absorb quite a bit. So a mentorship program could be formal. A good formal program is actually sponsored by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, a program called InfraGard, InfraGard. One of our viewers, Adam the Fantup, was asking us, how does he get started in the cybersecurity world? I said, join InfraGuard. It's a group of industry professionals. They do a background check on you, so you know, make sure you're willing to have that done. But it allows you to get access to a lot of information that is marked government use only. So you get to hear about certain types of things that are happening before the general public does. And it gets you access to a lot of industry professionals. So yeah, there's ways to do it. It's not really expensive. I actually was able to run my internship program on as little as $700 a month. And that was provided to me by a company in Honolulu called Diagnostic Laboratories. Thank you so very much. And that was enough so I could run classes so that the students could get some experience and learn the basics before they started in helping me do these big, giant articles for InfoWorld and before that, Internet Week. And then the very best of the students went to Interop with me. So you're going to need to find a firebrand in your organization that's willing to work with youngsters, and you need to go and set out some goals. Now, Oliver and Kurt, you both got to work with my students, and what do you think? Did I do okay?
They did great. You and
yeah.
Yeah, I will say that I have continued. There are probably half a dozen of your students, your former students, that I still keep up with in the industry. And they are all doing very well, very solid professionals. And the fact that they're solid professionals brings me to something, Lou, that I'd like to ask you. Now, it's one thing if you grow your own professionals for use within your own organization. But as we all know, in the tech world, once you gain a certain level of experience and, you know, in the security world, perhaps a certain level of notoriety, you're likely to want to test the waters to see if there is another job out there in another organization that could make you happier. From your position as a manager, would a professional who got their position through an internal mentorship program be as likely to make it through the hiring process as someone who had gotten there through, say, some credentialing or, you know, a college or independent study program that's a little more formal?
Yeah, I absolutely. From experience, I can tell you that I've dealt with a lot of people who've actually worked their way through an area that they're not familiar with. For instance, starting in software engineering, but moving into data science, let's say. Or, you know, somebody who's in data science who wants to get in security. I've seen both of those actually in my tenure as management. And these are people who got the job in security over somebody that they were trying to hire from the industry, right? So this is, they opened the job to everybody in the world, and this particular person ended up getting the job over them. And this is based off of mentorship. So, you know, what I like to try to do with anybody who reports to me or even doesn't report to me, people who just kind of reach out and ask, you know, if I have some thoughts on career moves and stuff like that, is getting them in touch with people that can really get and help them with their interests. And if they're interested in security and they want to learn more, who do they get to talk to? And of course, working at a company, software company, where you have lots of resources to do that, you know, having people reach out to the right person is a little easier. But I think the key here is once they're interested, they stay interested. And I think, you know, and by utilizing a mentor who's versed in this area and is an expert in that area, can really not only keep them motivated, but it helps them learn the information that they need to learn in a much more abridged way. And I think that's a key goal to even learning even going forward. And I think that helps them in the long term as well. And so, yeah, I definitely feel that, you know, a person who is trying to switch fields or even moving into a different field, using a mentor can be just as successful. In fact, even more successful in some cases than a person who's kind of developed their skills and worked through the industry and even has notoriety.
Very good. Now, Oliver, I want to ask you a question. In our part of the world, we tend to gain experience early in our careers through the more senior editors we work with. And, you know, as a writer, you depend on those editors to help you become a better writer. The downside is that it takes a good editor to help you become a better writer. And we also know that good writers don't necessarily become good editors. It's two different skill sets much of the time. So can you see any issues with this mentorship when a company may have perfectly good professionals at the higher levels who maybe aren't quite as good at sharing their information? I mean, we've seen the issue with good technologists being forced to become bad managers. Do you see any danger with the same thing happening with a mentorship program?
No, not if it is a little more formally managed. And I think that's where a lot of SMBs kind of trip up. Lou kind of glossed over it. The first time I encountered a, you know, formal mentorship program was at Microsoft. I never even heard of that. And I thought it was going to be a real pain in my, but it was awesome. And one of the things that was awesome about it is the guy had to take it seriously because it was part of his job. He was formally graded on it. And it helped me in terms of, am I a good writer? That analogy or not, as far as is my skill set going to really be best where I want it to go, or maybe it's more suited to somewhere else. For example, I thought I was going to go in one direction, and he and I had a lot of discussions. And he goes, you know, you'd probably be good at this other thing, which was product planning. And next thing you know, I'm investigating it. I'm meeting people over there. And I like the idea. So as far as a qualified mentor, I think any company, SMB, enterprise, whatever, should to some degree formalize the mentorship program. I think that can only help. That can only make it better. And unstructured format, in my opinion, is, like you said, that's kind of catch as catch can. Maybe you'll get – it's like college, right? You go to a really big college. Sometimes you have a professor who's really great. Sometimes you have one who just, you know, faces the chalkboard the whole day and you know, writes on the board and doesn't really care whether you learn anything. So, yeah, I mean, I would – and also, by the way, and then a side thought would be as far as retaining people at work – in this whole craze of gig economy and, you know, people switching jobs because they're all working from home and they feel disconnected. I honestly can't think of a better way to keep your employees connected and feeling as though the company cares about them than by instituting a really formal mentorship program that is actually watched and not necessarily controlled, but at least measured. That certainly at Microsoft made me feel, you know, surprisingly like a giant company like that really cared whether I lived or died. So yeah, I'm all in, it's all good. And frankly, the more, maybe not the more structure, but at least some structure is the best way to go about it.
I appreciate that. And I think we can all agree that if Oliver sees value in it and doesn't shoot it down, it's got to have something going for it. So, if you don't already have one, go out and find yourself a mentor. If you're interested in contributing back to the industry, become a mentor, regardless of the size of the organization. Well, we're a small organization here at Twyatt, and in order to keep us all going, we need to toss it back to our esteemed leader, Lou, to take us on to the next part of the program.
Thank you, Curtis. That's right. That does it for the Bites. We will head into the host roundtable in just a moment. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Linode. Cloud services and hosting are always on organizations' minds. That means you're probably either looking at Linode already or maybe even using it or maybe not. But either way, Linode is the way to go. Whether you're developing a personal project or managing larger workloads, you deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing solutions. Now, with Linode, building applications using a simple Cloud Manager API or CLI, quickly scale up or down with standard VMs, dedicated CPUs, and enterprise-grade GPUs. If you haven't chosen Linode yet, you might be asking, why choose Linode? Well, you'll get a support experience above the rest. People choose Linode because they demand a better customer support experience. Linode's independence and mission drive them to a different standard where the customer is the driving force behind everything they do. They have pay-as-you-go, predictable and transparent pricing. In fact, Linode pioneered that model, that predictable flat pricing model for cloud computing. No more anxiety over hidden costs. They make it simple to launch and scale in the cloud because with Linode, you'll get flat pricing across every global data center, an intuitive cloud manager, a full-featured API, best-in-class documentation, and award-winning support. That means that Linode makes it easy to manage your applications in the cloud. Not only that, but Linode has proven secure and reliable enterprise-grade infrastructure. With their extensive peering relationships and their next-generation network, Linode delivers the modern infrastructure and performance you need to innovate at scale. I found with Linode, they are one-stop shop, so you don't have to look anywhere else. Whatever you want to do, you can host your website and build your app, store or back up your media. Plus, you can easily launch and enrich your developer applications, hosted services, websites, AI and machine learning workloads, gaming services, or CI/CD environments. And you can launch and scale in the cloud with their virtual machines. You can even choose shared and dedicated compute instances, or you can use your $100 in credit on S3 compatible object storage, managed Kubernetes, and more. There are a lot of cloud providers out there right now that don't make things easy to do and want to stay productive. That's right. Some of them have dashboards coming out their ears. Not with Linode. I actually found them to be really easy to use. In fact, Linode was rated the easiest to use by G2 Crowd in 2021. That's why cloud developers choose Linode, because they make managing complex cloud infrastructure easy with simple bundled pricing, full-featured APIs, and 100% human support. Linode helped pioneer cloud computing back in 2003, 3 years before AWS, so they have the longevity you know can be trusted. Develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications faster and easier. Get $100 in credit. Visit linode.com/Twyatt. That's linode.com/Twyatt. And we thank Linode for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we have a special treat today. We have a host roundtable. Now, we talk a lot about the movement in the cloud and how organizations continually try to digitally transform every aspect of their business. This includes the ability to even use online payments services to help meet their needs. Now, let me give you some facts here before we get into the discussion. First, cash use in the last years accounted for only 19% of all payments, down 7% points from 2019. That means that it seems like people are slowly moving away from cash on average. Now, average value of cash held in consumers' pockets increased to $74, up from $20 from 2019. That's interesting as well. Now, approximately 72% of U.S. consumers reported making an in-person payment, which is actually down from 91% in 2019. That means more people doing online. Now, total spending on not in-person, non-bill payment increased substantially at grocery stores, dining establishments, and general merchandise locations. Now, the question is, what's the road look like to a cashless society? Now, we have lots of different topics related to this today, but I wanted to go around the table here and have the co-hosts maybe give their top of minds here and maybe where they see things go. Now, Cheebert, I want to start with you first. What's the world look like in a cashless society?
Well, there's been lots and lots of people that have proposed what a cashless society would look like. Heinlein, just any science fiction author. Now, what almost all of them do is they have a mix. They have a mix of, you know, your credit chip or something that's tied to your identity. But almost every single one of them also have an untraceable cash chip that they can use. So I'm actually a little on the middle ground here. I don't think we're ever going to get to a completely cashless society. But I think we're going to eventually get to the point where the so-called credit chip or tying it to our phone or something like that is going to become a lot more ubiquitous. I'm already seeing that trend now. I think the U.S. Credit card industry is going to have to get their behinds in gear. The amount of fraud is absolutely staggering, and we need to do better. I think there's going to be cash chips. So I think it's right down the middle. I think we're going to see something. Walden University, I think, you know, cruising through that article, kind of seems to have a little bit of both. I just think we need to do a lot better on the security of these credit instruments. And the U.S. credit card industry just isn't keeping up. I mean, Europeans have had chip and PIN forever, which is not perfect, but it is significantly better. And magstripes and things like that are so last century. Come on, guys. Anyway, that's my rant. And I'd love to hear Oliver's spin on this because he's like the total curmudgeon. And I'm dying to hear what he says.
All right, Oliver, we'll give you the bully pulpit here.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
How am I waiting?
Let's hear it.
Okay, it's never going to happen. All right, it's never going to happen. You're blowing smoke up everyone's butt. It's not even possible. Okay, the reason being, in the front, you guys are thinking like engineers, right? Version 2 is better than version 1, ergo version 2 will eventually replace version 1. That's not how it works in the financial sector, right? Coins were supposed to replace barter. Paper was supposed to replace coins, on up through investments, cryptocurrencies, whatever. Nothing replaced anything ever. It's just more options. You open up more options to more things, right? Cryptocurrency, okay, I got a new way to invest. I got a new way to launder money. I got a new way to lose money. But no, you're never going to replace cash. In fact, I was reading up on this, but before the show, New Zealand polled the New Zealand Reserve Bank actually polled their entire population. I think they got 7,000 respondents. Would they mind having a national digital currency? And the response was overwhelmingly negative, with the soundbite quote being, "We need cash as much as we need access to clean water." All right. And Colombia actually tried this. They turned two towns in a rural area completely cashless. They wanted to. Turns out nobody would do away with all the cash. They kept undermining it with cash. The people didn't get it. They had these training classes and festivals, and people kept thinking that the money was inside the mobile device. And if they lost their phone, they lost all their money. And then there was just a general distrust and a general lack of privacy that people feared. And yeah, like you're going to say, okay, this is rural Colombia, but you can map that to the U.S. no problem on a much larger scale. And in the U.S., you're going to toss conspiracy theorists into the mix. If you look at those GoFundMe trucker thing, right, when GoFundMe shut down the fundraising for those right-wing Canadian truckers, that's the example. If you search on social sites like, say, Reddit or Facebook, that's the example that people are bringing up as a blocker to a digital currency or a big fear of digital currency. Because if the government has access or controls the digital currency, if they don't like you for whatever reason, they can just wipe out all of your money. And yeah, that sounds like Illuminati conspiracy theorist type stuff. But ask me, like, think about it. If Russia was on an all digital currency right now, what would Putin be doing to people who that he didn't like? Like, it's a far reach, but it's not impossible. So no, I don't think you're ever going to see all digital. I think the technologies are great. Don't get me wrong. I use it too. It's very convenient. You know, we can talk about that, but the word replace, never in a million years. It's just, no, you will always have to have all of them. Anything new, you will have to have all the previous systems until the end of time.
Interesting. What about you, Curtis? What do you think of that?
Well, I agree with Oliver that completely replacing cash won't happen in the same way that barter still exists. I mean, you can, from agricultural societies right up to what we do now. I mean, I have in the last, 20 years bartered logo design for custom clothing. I have, done that kind of bartering, and that's not at all rare. What I do think is that cash will become a less and less important part of the overall financial picture around the world. And where this is really important is in the developing world. you want to talk about places where finance is difficult. Many of the developing nations are on a cash economy. And what we find is that cash is a very, very dangerous way to transfer value. Why? Because, to put it bluntly, one $10 bill looks just like any other $10 bill. And it's very possible to come up and hit someone in the head and take away their $10 bills, and they have no recourse. So one of the things that a number of organizations, including World Bank, based here in the U.S., and an organization called CREST in the U.K. are doing, are trying to figure out how to help developing nations put banks into operation for their population. In many places, what you have are things that are known in the global industry as challenger banks. In a lot of places, these turn out to be mobile telephone companies, where essentially people will take cash, go to a local store, and put value into a mobile phone SIM card. Once it's in the mobile phone system, then it can be transferred to another user of that mobile telephone system and even converted into to cash or other forms of value trade. It's critical to make that happen. Now, the place where I have difficulty seeing a lot of long-term value for the developed world, for the industrialized world, I am bearish on cryptocurrencies. Blockchain, huge fan. Cryptocurrencies, not so much. You get into some different situations in other parts of the world, but where I do think they could have a continuing value is in that cash equivalency. You're looking for something, you know, Brian mentioned it, where you have a cash token and a non-cash token. Well, cryptocurrencies could become the cash equivalent. Difficult to trace, highly anonymous, and yet somewhat more difficult to simply go in and steal than physical dollars are. So I think that rather than saying it's a cashless society that we're going towards, it will be more accurate to say a cash minimal society in the long run.
Indeed, indeed. Good viewpoints here. Good viewpoint. We have lots more to talk about here. I do want to make sure that we let the audience know that we're coming back. We have lots more to talk about. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Nareva. Now, hybrid work is here to stay. That means people are going back to work, and meetings will be remote and on-site with workers on-site. Complicated and costly. That has been the state of audio conferencing for larger spaces for a long time. Now, choosing a traditional system might require difficult design software and selecting from a dizzying array of separate mics, speakers, DSPs, and much more. Now, in those cases, installation usually requires outside technicians, and it's often highly invasive and expensive. Plus, it could take your room offline for days. And the industry was definitely primed for the same type of leap in technology that had transformed and simplified other sectors. Nareva made that leap when they created revolutionary microphone Mist technology. Now, with this technology, one or two integrated microphones and speaker bars fill a room with thousands of virtual microphones. There are no dead zones, and everyone can be heard everywhere in the room. Meeting and class participants can simply talk naturally and move naturally in the space, and it can still be heard by remote participants anywhere. Now, thanks to continuous auto calibration, your rooms are instantly and always ready with optimized audio. No outside technician required here. Now, Nareva also simplified installation. It's a 30-minute do-it-yourself job. That means big savings on time and cost compared to traditional systems. They simplified management too. Nareva console gives IT the power to monitor, manage, and adjust their systems from anywhere. No need for IT to go from room to Room. So ask yourself if you want to go with the costly and complicated traditional system or make the leap to simple and economical Nureva. Learn more at Nureva.com. That's N-U-R-E-V-A.com. And we thank Nureva for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been having a host roundtable here. We've been talking about the world and how it would look if we moved to a cashless world. Now, we have lots of points of view here. I want to give my little two cents here, because I think Oliver brought up a good point. We tend to sometimes think a little bit too engineering-like or too technical-like. I'm going to go the engineering route, though. I'm going to take the engineering route and say that obviously lots of businesses continue to do better when it comes to using online payments versus using cash. And that's just because, like Kurt said, there's a lot of people stealing money, a lot of people taking money, hiding money, and it's a lot harder to trace when you're talking about physical currency. I think the key here is, though, there is some challenge with online payment systems. You have lots of payment systems out there today. You know, you have things like, you know, we talked a little bit about Square, there's Stripe. There's, you know, there's lots of other services that are offering the ability to add payment systems or payment to your website. Like, for instance, Bolt, most recently Fast. And I want to poke on Fast a little bit right now. Fast was a startup. It was actually partially funded by Stripe. And they were a way for organizations to add payments to their websites, to their software very easily just by dropping these components on there. The key here is there was lots of internal stuff going on in that company, and they ended up just closing their doors, and their customers were kind of like laid out to dry just one day. I think this is a perfect example of organizations that you know, will struggle because they choose the wrong provider, the wrong service. And I think that's one of the reasons why we will see us going to a cashless society much slower. Now, you see the trends. We see the trends. I talked about the data in the very beginning, you know, how 19% of all payments were still cash. That is down, but it's not that far down. In fact, I saw data from like 2012, and it was like 22%. So I think that like we're moving very slowly there. And I think, yes, the technology is available in there. It's chip and PIN. It's online payment services. It's things like Square and Stripe. But there's still some trust issues there. There's still some adoption issues. It costs a lot. There's lots per transaction. Businesses of all scales have challenges with payment and paying those types of things. So we'll continue to see a movement towards it very slowly, but I think it'll be very slow. Now, I want to throw this back to Chibert, because Chibert, there's some other technologies that are moving us into that direction, right?
Yeah, actually, a lot of people aren't aware that there is an offering called LTE Cat M1, and it's designed for low bandwidth. So if you're only running credit card transactions, you can potentially keep under a meg per month. Now, as long as you're just doing credit card transactions, it actually doesn't use a ton of data. Typical credit card authorization only uses about 130 characters. So with 130 characters and not a whole heck of a lot of headers that you have to deal with, you could potentially fit under a meg per month. And LTE Cat M1 from certain carriers is only $7.46 a month the last time I paid mine. So that's making it, you know, much, much easier for those little carts. Like, you know, like the coffee cart. I had some of the best coffee I've ever had from a coffee cart in Central Park. And they took Square. And that's super cool. And from a technology standpoint, you know, being an engineer, that's cool. Especially since a lot of these carriers... are now allowing you to put virtual machines and microservices at the central office. So instead of, like, for instance, a typical cellular connection, say I'm in Florida, my APN happens to be in Walnut Creek, California. So that means every transaction has to go all the way to Walnut Creek, get onto the internet, and then come all the way back, even if I'm only hitting a transaction, say, in Orlando. gets even worse in Hawaii. But by putting microservices or virtual machines actually into the central office, these credit card transactions or whatever data happens really, really fast. So from a technology standpoint, it's becoming a lot more approachable, a lot more implementable, whatever adjective you want, for smaller and smaller organizations. And one of the lesser known things, there used to be penalties when you did credit card transactions under a certain amount. Your credit card per transaction fees would skyrocket. So that's why there's always, you got to pay cash for it. Well, those limits are gone. And so while I agree with Oliver that, yeah, we haven't seemed to be able to go to a lot of other things, and I agree with the chat room that, you know, it's probably got the same kind of possibility as the U.S. going metric. I keep hoping. Anyway, enough rant.
Gentle rant.
Interesting point of view. I like the concept of the, you know, this, the, you're talking about the online payments, these devices that cost less, use less power, have all connectivity, and you can still use them for payments. Oliver, I want to throw this to you because you talk a lot with small and medium businesses, you know, and we just kind of talked about a concept of the fact that small businesses could accept less and less cash. The question to you, though, is this safer for them to do that?
Is it safer? Less a question of safe, although in short, I don't think so. But Kurt's probably a better guy to answer that question. But as far as adoption goes, it's for them. It's less a question of safe than what they understand, right? You feel safer facing the threats that you understand than you do facing threats that you don't. So that's the problem with any digital currency is, what, 80, 90% of the population really doesn't understand exactly how their money's in danger. They know that it is. They just don't know how, right? Kurt was saying, if you have a fistful of 10, somebody can bop you over the head and take the money. Yes, but on the other hand, I understand that threat. So being Kurt, I'll take one of my many guns and I'll take a different route to the bank. And then I have a reasonable expectation of facing that threat. Whereas on a digital side, you don't know who's stealing it. You're not really sure how. You're not sure where it's going to go. And worse, you don't really know who's going to help you once it's gone, right? Those are all nebulous concepts. And that's as true for individuals as it is for small businesses. So, yeah, small businesses are going to want to be as open as they can as far as accepting any kind of payment that any customer is willing to give them, as long as they feel reasonably safe doing so. And as a lot of these new technologies, especially evidenced by companies like the one you pointed out, people feel unsafe using them. So if the society really wants to move to a digital, you know, cashless society, then this is one area where it can't be based on private enterprise. That's just not going to work. I mean, people were hiding their money under their mattresses or their little gold nuggets under their mattresses, and the only reason that they put them in national banks is because the government said we're going to insure your money. Before that, who was going to give their money to some guy behind a counter? Nope. Nobody. And something like that has to happen for digital currencies to become a dominant force, right? I mean, I think we're all kind of agreeing. I'm being more of a tool about it, but we're all kind of agreeing that it's not going to happen. You know, you can't flip a switch. It's always going to be there. And for there to be any worth to cash, the entire system has to remain in place. You can't do away with any part of the system for a certain economic exchange to keep working. So, yeah, popularity may change, and I certainly hope that it does, but replacing, no. I'm sorry if I wandered off the rails there from the SMB side, but ask me again. I forgot your question.
I'm going to say that I think that what Oliver points out, I'm going to draw an analogy between similar to the difference between classical mechanics in physics and quantum mechanics. You have classical mechanics that work perfectly for large things, planets, cars, bodies, you know, golf balls. But at the subatomic level, they break down. Quantum, perfect for individual particles, subatomic particles. But to say that, you know, this bus simply shows a tendency to exist at a given point in time, it breaks down. And so where I think that cash is going to be keying for a long time is what I would call the microtransaction level. You want to walk in and buy a newspaper somewhere, cash. You want to walk in many places, buy a single cup of coffee, cash. Now, you want to walk in and buy a Mercedes, probably cash is going to be problematic. Not to say it can't be done, but the friction involved in that transaction gets really high. So I think what we're going to see is, and I say this as someone who has, in fact, whipped out my American Express card to pay for a $2 item simply because I had no cash with me. But I think we will see cash living for small transactions. There will always be some individuals and some small businesses that are happy dealing with cash for a variety of philosophical, political, whatever reasons. But I think for transactions over a certain threshold, and that may be $10, it may be $100, it may be $1,000. But above that threshold, some sort of electronic payment, whether it be, you know, cryptocurrency or a something based on a credit card, something based on a debit card, you know, any of those things will work. For the microtransactions, cash is going to still live there.
Cash is king. Well, folks, time flies when you're having fun. Great discussion today, guys. You've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twiet. I want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially these guys right here, my co-hosts, starting with our very own Mr. Oliver Riss. Oliver, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you?
I'm going to start a cashless payment system. But aside from that, what am I doing? Oh, yeah. Well, like I said, I'll be testing. They still haven't changed my bio. I'll be testing CRM systems followed by wonderful email marketing systems, which are kind of the same companies. So I'm basically up to my eyes in sales and MarTech for the next 2 months.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it. Thank you, Oliver, for being here. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin as well. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week? Where can people find you and all your work?
Well, as for finding me, you can always do that on Twitter at KG4GWA. You can follow me on LinkedIn, Instagram, any of a number of social media sites. I'm going to have at least one article up on Dark Reading this coming week, talking about the importance of culture, but at a different end of the training process than most people think of it. I have a couple of other articles on the way. And as I've been saying, I've got my big research coming up on cybersecurity awareness training. So that's occupying lots of my time. Please feel free to direct message me on any of the social networks. Send me email. Always happy to hear from members of the Twiet Riot.
Thank you, Curtis. Thanks for being here. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Brian Chi as well. Chiebert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter, ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. You're also welcome to drop me an email. I'm Chiebert at twit.tv. Or you're welcome to also drop a line to Twiet at twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. Now, one thing that is going to be happening is I'm putting together a whole bunch of classes for our local makerspace. And it occurs to me that some of the folks have asked me some questions about some fairly advanced networking topics. Hey, chat room, would you be interested if I live streamed it, say, on YouTube? I'm especially thinking someone kept asking me about multicast when I was talking about multicast, and maybe I should live stream my multicast routing class. So I'd love to hear from you whether you want to see that, or maybe I'll just record it and then put it up on YouTube or something. Don't know. We'll see. Love to hear from you. And folks, love to hear your show ideas too. Anyway, take care. Have fun.
Thank you, Chief Rip. Well, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who comes in each and every week. You drop by to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now. Go to twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, show notes, co-host information, guest information, and the links to the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices, because we're on all of them, because we're on all of those podcasts or applications. So definitely check them out and subscribe. Plus, you may have heard, that's right, Club Twit. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. I promise you, it's only $7 per month, and it's a great way to stay on top of all of our podcasts out there. Plus, there's a lot of great things that come with it as well. There's the exclusive access to the members-only Discord channel. Plus, you can chat with hosts and producers. You can have separate discussions in different channels. Plus, there's always special events. Lots of fun discussions happening there. So join Club Twit and be part of the fun. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit. Plus, Club Twit now offers group plans as well. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free tech podcast. The plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of just $6 a month, and you can add as many seats as you like. And in fact, it's really a great way to have your IT departments, your developers, your salespeople, your tech teams just stay on top of all of our podcasts like everyone else. And just like the regular memberships, they can join those Twit Discord server and get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So definitely join Club Twit at twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with the gift of Twiat, because we talk a lot about fun tech topics on the show, and I guarantee they will find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely give them the gift of Twiat and share the show. Now, if you've already subscribed, you know, we do the show live. That's right, live.twit.tv at 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays. We do the show live. Come see how the pizza's made, all the behind the scenes, the banter that we do during the show and before the show. So come check it out and be part of the live show. Now, if you're going to be part of the live show, you might as well be part of the live chat room as well. We also have the infamous IRC channel. That's right. You could get to it at irc.twit.tv. We have a lot of famous characters in there that join us each and every week. Lots of great topics and discussions we have in there. So definitely join the chat room and be part of the fun and the movement as well. Now, you know, definitely hit me up, because I want to hear your show ideas. I want to have discussions with you. Twitter.com/LouMM. Direct message me. Post your messages. Send me messages, whether it's in inline replies or just a direct message. I love hearing from people. I have lots of great tech topics, discussions I have on there, whether it's enterprise tidbits or show ideas. Plus, if you want to know what's going on in my work week, I post it there as well. And you can also check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your office experience to make it more powerful, more productive for your organization. So definitely check that out and be part of the productivity platform. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do this show without them. So thank you to all their support. I also want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. They make this show possible. I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chi. He's not only our co-host, he's co-host today, but he's also our tireless producer. That's why he does all the show bookings and the plannings for the show behind the scenes, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chiebert, for all your support. Of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor, Anthony. He's our behind the scenes man. He's the guy that makes us sound good after we make all those mistakes. So thank you, Anthony, for fixing all of our mistakes, making us sound good. Plus, our TD, our technical director today, he's the talented Mr. Ant Pruitt, and he does an amazing show called Hands-On Photography. I love hearing about all the topics that come up on that show each and every week. Ant, what's going on this week on Hands-On Photography?
Thank you, Mr. Liu. Well, this time I had the honor and pleasure of being joined by Mr. Terrell Lloyd. He is the team photographer for the San Francisco 49ers. And, well, we got really down and dirty into some photography discussions. And I got to apologize, everybody. Normally, my show, I'll give you about 20 minutes or, you know, for an episode. This one's about an hour. So, yeah, we went a little long, but, man, it was such a great conversation. So cool. And I hope everyone enjoys it.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Ant. Look forward to listening to that one as well. Well, folks, and until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.
Is that an iPhone in your hand? Wait a second. Is that an Apple Watch on your wrist? And do I see an iPad sitting there on the table? Oh, my goodness. You are the perfect person to be watching iOS Today, the show where Rosemary Orchard and I, Micah Sargent, talk all things iOS, tvOS, watchOS, HomePodOS. It's all the OSs that Apple has on offer, and we show you how to make the most of those gadgets. Just head to twit.tv/iOS to check it out.